Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on Joe Stahura tendering his resignation as mayor of the city of Whiting. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a federal eviction moratorium effective until the end of December. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Lake County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Weiser. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Whiting City Attorney Denise Sejna announced Tuesday evening that Mayor Joseph Stahura tendered his resignation as mayor of the city to the clerk of the Lake Circuit Court. City Council President Chris Savonides assumes the duties of mayor until the position is filled by a Democratic Party caucus. Stahura will appear in federal court to answer to mail and tax fraud charges in connection with diverting re-election campaign money to his family's personal use. The U.S. Attorney's Office agreed to recommend that he receive leniency in return for his cooperation with investigators looking into the case.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
A city police officer facing termination over allegations he chipped a man's tooth in March 2019 by pushing his face into a police car is the target of other investigations, the nature of which could not be discussed during a hearing Wednesday. The Times reports Gary Patrolman Terry Pack, the past president of the Gary Fraternal Order of Police Lodge, defended his decision to escalate an encounter with Gary resident Rasan Hamilton on May 19, 2019, and repeatedly denied touching Hamilton's head. Peck's testimony conflicted with statements by two other officers who said they were nearby when Peck pulled over Hamilton but did not witness Hamilton commit any traffic violations. One of the officers said Peck gave Hamilton one order after another, never leaving enough time for Hamilton to comply. Peck testified he stopped Hamilton in the 3300 block of Grant Street after Hamilton swerved through traffic lanes of traffic. Peck said he was looking for the silver Chevrolet Cavalier Hamilton was driving because it had pulled up to the scene of an earlier domestic disturbance at an apartment building in the 3300 block of Pierce Street. Peck said the men in the vehicle argued with a man involved in the domestic dispute and that the man in the domestic dispute suggested they had been sent by a woman to fight him. Hamilton testified he pulled up to ask police if he would be able to get through because their cars were partially blocking the road and an officer, who testimony showed was Peck, used an expletive while telling him to go around. Hamilton said he backed up and drove down a side street, dropped off his two relatives, and was pulled over by Peck after exiting a McDonald's drive-through on Grant Street. He said he asked Peck why he'd been pulled over, and Peck replied, quote, fast, saying something about traffic. Other officers testified Hamilton repeatedly asked why he'd been stopped and didn't comply with Peck's numerous orders to produce his driver's license and registration. Peck said Hamilton finally agreed to produce his identification, but by then, quote, we were past that. Peck said Hamilton shut off his car as ordered, but Peck opened Hamilton's door, grabbed him by the arm, and pulled him out. Peck said he thought Hamilton reached for the door to shut it, but patrolman Daryl Gordon said he thought Hamilton was reaching for the door to comply with Peck's orders to get out. Detective Olivia Vasquez said she thought Hamilton was unbuckling his seatbelt and had his license and registration in his hand, which flew into the street when he was pulled from the car. Police Chief Brian Evans says Peck's arrest of Hamilton was, quote, highly unusual, and it was remarkable that two other sworn officers came forward and made written reports alleging Peck used excessive force. The Times reports Evans wasn't aware of any other time in which an excessive force complaint has been filed against one officer by another. Vasquez, who worked alongside Peck as a patrol officer on midnights in the city's Glen Park section in March 2019, filed the complaint. Peck, who was suspended for one day in 2008 for conduct unbecoming of a police officer, and for 60 days in 2013 for violating a sick leave policy, is facing termination for alleged violations of department rules on use of excessive force, failure to adhere to the law, discourteous behavior, lack of professionalism, conduct unbecoming, and more. When asked if it would be possible for the Gary Police Department to continue to employ Peck, Evans said, quote, "I do not."
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana University School of Medicine announced Thursday it has been selected to participate as part of an international COVID-19 vaccine trial. IU will recruit 1,500 trial participants to determine if the COVID-19 vaccine in development by pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca is both safe and effective. This would be the final stage needed for FDA approval of the drug. IU School of Medicine is one of 81 sites across the country that will host a trial for the AstraZeneca vaccine, and the only one in Indiana.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana is evaluating how Hoosiers will be affected by the recent eviction moratorium issued by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The federal moratorium is effective until the end of December. Indiana Housing and Community Development Executive Director Jacob Seip says there are several criteria people must meet in order to avoid evictions. First, people have to at least apply for as much government assistance as possible. Second, the moratorium only applies to people who will make less than $99,000 this year or $198,000 for those filing jointly. Seip says people have to affirm under penalty of perjury that they can't make full rent payments because of loss of income.
Could be a layoff, or there could be an extraordinary out-of-pocket medical expenses that the household may have experienced as well.
The moratorium only applies if people are doing their best to make at least partial rent payments. And lastly, people can still get evicted unless they have nowhere else to go besides something like a homeless shelter.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana State Board of Education has approved a method to maintain funding for schools reopening virtually this fall after warnings of possible cuts from lawmakers last month. The board unanimously approved a plan Wednesday that allows the state to use data from the previous student count in February to determine whether schools should receive full funding for their students, regardless of whether they are instructing students only over the internet or in person. School budgets won't be penalized for students learning virtually this fall as long as the students weren't enrolled in a full-time virtual education program on the last enrollment count day.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
With just 1 month left to respond to the census, community groups are working to ensure everyone is counted. The U.S. Census Bureau will stop counting at the end of September, a month earlier than planned. That could threaten the accuracy of the census if many people go uncounted. Kelly Coors is executive director of the Evansville Department of Metropolitan Development. He says they're working with the local census office to target historically undercounted neighborhoods during these final weeks to ensure a complete count of the region. Since mid-July, the census has been conducting in-person follow-ups across the country. The Census Bureau is urging people to answer the census questions by phone or online at www.census.gov.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Rural broadband could be a main focus for Hoosier farmers in the upcoming legislative session. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, farmers across the state gathered virtually last weekend to discuss what issues should be taken to the Indiana State House.
Due to the pandemic, farmers called into the Indiana Farm Bureau's first virtual delegate session. Hours of discussion included the role of township government, confined animal feeding operations known as CAFOs, and rural broadband. President Randy Crone says internet access has become essential for agriculture, from technology used out in the fields to e-learning for children.
Broadband is probably the one that comes to the top of the stack right now, and a lot of concern about rural areas, which, you know, that's been heightened because of COVID-19.
Even with the state cutting the budget, Crone says right now is the time to work towards fixing the problem and getting the state to at least develop a long-term plan. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
As some Midwest school districts open with in-person classes, school nurses face a big challenge. They play a crucial role in keeping kids safe from COVID-19, and they have to handle many other health issues. In this feature, a middle school nurse in Fort Dodge, Iowa, tells Side Effects Public Media's Natalie Krebs how she's preparing.
My name is Amanda Zimmerman, and I am a registered nurse here at the Fort Dodge Middle School, which is part of Fort Dodge Community School District. And this is my fifth year here.
It's something different every day. Never get the same thing twice with the kids. You know, we see not only medical issues, but mental health issues, psychosocial issues. I know that our plan is to come back to school. I don't remember what the latest number is, but, you know, we did offer an online option to parents and students that did not feel comfortable putting their kids to school. So we have that. I'm excited. The kids need it. You know, there's so much more that goes along with school than just them being able to talk to their friends also. It's keeping an eye on those kids that maybe don't get fed every day, or maybe, you know, Iowa has pretty high numbers for child abuse. And since the kids haven't been in school, they've seen those reported numbers actually go down. And it's not because the kids aren't being abused. It's because the staff who were checking on those aren't seeing them. So I'm super excited. I'm a little nervous. I think everybody is, but again, we've put our plan in place hoping that we've created something to try to keep everybody safe. Some schools obviously are checking everybody's temperatures. We're not going to do that. I would spend my whole day checking 1,200 kids' temperature and probably be done in just enough time to start over the next day. But, you know, if a kid comes in sick, we do have some protocols set up for if they meet certain criteria, what we will do with them. It's increased cleaning. And again, I said we typically see 120 kids a day in the nurse's office. So that's going to change. They won't be able to just come to the nurse when they want. The teacher will send a request. One of the nurses will go gather 4 students at a time. So 2 can wait in our waiting room. 1 can be in each of our rooms. That other nurse will be cleaning in between as those students leave. So it'll be kind of like a scheduled appointment so that we're not overfilling the nurse's office with students at one time. Parents are really going to have to give us good phone numbers and extra people that we can call because not every parent works in town, right? And we know that. But I can't have a child sitting in my office for an hour and a half this year either that might be symptomatic. So it's about, you know, who can the parents rely on? What can the staff do? Because obviously our nurse's office is not super big. And so I don't have an area that I can let all these kids hang out sick. And even if I do, we don't know that they have the same illness. So it's really about trying to keep kids separate, trying to do the best that we can. Even if we send them home, you know, a little early and we jump the gun, I think I'd rather send them home than have them stay and then infect another whole classroom. You know, I'm a little nervous because we've not done this before, but I think in everything that you do, if I was to start a new job, I'd be nervous, right? Because we all get that way when it's something we've not done. But I have a job to do. I'm a nurse. I know how to take care of patients. You know, this is what we go to school for. And so I'm not going to lie and say I'm not nervous, because I am a little bit, but I know that we've done the best that we can for our district. You know, the school nurse's job is not just to kiss boo-boos when we fall down, right? A school nurse's job is actually, the definition is, it's to do the best for the majority. And so with being in a pandemic, this is really looking at what's doing the best job that we can for the majority. And even if that means maybe a couple kids can't come to school because, you know, they're higher risk, it's what's doing the best for the majority of the district. I think everybody needs to just breathe. I think everybody needs to just take a deep breath and know that we're all in this together, and that there's so many unknowns still that we don't know, and we can't fix it all or solve it all in a day. So everybody just needs to go in every day and do the best job that they can.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Lake County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Weiser.
Whiting Mayor Joe Stahura is due to be in federal court in Hammond on September 9th to appear for the charges against him that have led basically to another person who in Northwest Indiana has been well respected as a politician, as a community leader, and has gotten himself in trouble. And with us to talk more about the legacy of Joe Stahura, we have Lake County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Weiser with us. And Jim, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me, Chris. Not exactly the topic I'm excited to talk about.
Well, but, no, I don't I think understand. It is. It was quite a shock, I'm sure, to you and a lot of people in the Democratic Party organization here in Lake County to hear about the news when it came out last week about Mayor Stahura.
It was. Known the mayor for quite some time. I can't say in terms of the performance in office as a mayor, he's been outstanding. He's turned an entire city around, made it a kind of a diamond in the rough. And it's just so sad that someone performs their governmental duties so effectively and so brilliantly, I might add, and then to have this happen is just terribly sad.
I know that his attorney, Kerry Connor, is quoted in the Times last week as saying that her client has his reputation as a dynamic mayor, a dedicated family man, very well known in the region because of that, too. And as say, it's very sad that these situations happen like this, that the charges came up as were announced by the U.S. Attorney's Office last week. Attorney Thomas Kirsch had said in a statement that it was another black eye for Northwest Indiana, and I'm sure it's not one that you or many of the other members of the Lake County Democratic Organization are proud of.
Well, no, we're certainly not, and I don't think anybody should be accepting of it, not just folks in our organization, but just folks in general. I put a little different spin on it. It certainly is a sad situation for the mayor. The idea that and the penchant for the U.S. attorney to always use the term another black eye, I think it's a little bit misplaced this time. Apparently, unbeknownst to any of us, the mayor had an issue, an issue that a lot of people struggle with in their daily lives. People struggle with certain types of addiction all the time. He clearly had an issue, or at least by looking at the terms of the indictment, there was an issue with gambling. And I'm not suggesting or excusing anything that took place. It was wrong, assuming, and he's pled guilty, or at least he's preliminarily pled guilty, and the plea, as you pointed out, is going to be heard next week in federal court. But just based on that, it's not an act that he was engaged in his official capacity as mayor.
No.
He never did anything, or there's no allegation, let me put it this way, no allegation that he ever did anything wrong, improper, illegal as a mayor. What he did do as an elected official who has a campaign committee appears to have improperly utilized the money in that campaign committee, not taxpayers' dollars, but the money that was in the campaign committee. And I'm not excusing that, but that's what took place. So we're not talking about, I don't want to be comparing apples and oranges, as apparently the U.S. attorney is doing, saying, well, it's another black eye because it's an elected official. Well, this isn't someone that violated the law of bribery or the law of misuse of violation of honest services. This is a person who made him who did wrong. There's no question about that. But it's in a different category, and it's a sad category because it's a personal flaw, and that many people have to seek help for and have to seek guidance for. And I know I kind of like ramble on here, but the point is, I guess that if he was just Joe, people would tend to say, "Oh, that's that's too bad. That person needs help. That person needs to get guidance. That person needs to maybe get some psychological or therapeutic assistance." But if you're Mayor Joe, that goes out the window, and you're just another guilty person. And so my only point for making that is it doesn't fall into the same category.
Now, Jim, if you would, I wanted you to come on and talk about this for a reason as well, talking about Mayor Stuhura, but also because you're a Democratic Party chairman, a veteran in working with people who have never run for public office and helping them get ready to run for public office, I'm sure that they have to be schooled. They can't all be totally knowledgeable about all of the fine points of raising money for campaigns. And I guess you could say maybe the hazards or even temptations that the campaign contributions that go into the bank to help pay for the expenses of a campaign can really be, which I'm sure is what was the case here with Mayor Stuhura. It's their temptation, and I'm sure that you really have to work hard when you get a new candidate. Let them know that these are certain things that you can and cannot do.
That's a great point, Chris, and we do that. And we not only do we advise them that, look, there's different facets to running for office and advise them about the nature and type of campaigning, but also advise them initially that you have to file and you have to form a committee and you have to file your financial reports, and they get provided with the documentation that explains all that. But in addition to that, the Indiana State Democratic Party holds training sessions for new candidates, with portions of which include what you can do and what you can't do, and how a campaign report needs to be filled out, and what you're obligated to do when you receive those funds, and what they can be used and not used for. So all candidates are made aware of that, and the state operates it, but I make sure anytime I see the state sends it to me as county chairman and says, "Hey, Jim, on such and such a date or on such and such dates, we're going to hold these training sessions." I immediately notify all our new candidates and say, "I expect you and would ask that you attend," and usually they're virtual, but sometimes they're in person. Mm-hmm. "You attend these sessions and look at this and realize what you're obligated to do." We do that regularly.
Do you find that it seems confusing, or do they pretty much, after they've had the explanation and all of the examples, things to do and not do, that they seem to pretty much understand?
You know, I find that I don't get a whole lot of questions about it. I do get follow-up questions, I will tell you, and at times I can answer it. At times I refer them to Michelle Fehman, our election director, and at times I'll refer them downstate to people that both Michelle and I might consider more qualified and appropriate to answer their questions. But it seems like the question always becomes, there's no real definition in what constitutes a campaign expense. That's the category around which most of the issues come. Everybody understands what a campaign contribution is, and everybody understands the limitations. We give them the statutory limitations that are the obligation under Indiana law that corporations can't exceed over $1,000 or $1,500 payment in an annual year or contribution, things of that nature. But we advise them that they always ask, geez, what constitutes a campaign expense? I'm going to I'm invited to a senior citizens bingo, and I go to the bingo and I take a gift that they can raffle off at the bingo. Is that appropriate? And you say, well, if you're doing that and you're campaigning and they've asked you there in your capacity as a candidate or an official, yes, you can. You just need to document it and show that it was part of the campaign. I've even had questions, Chris, like, hey, you know, I go out in public all the time, and I want to make sure, and I've got to go to these functions. Is what if I get a haircut? Well, you know, what does a haircut qualify as? It's all these little nuances, and it's always my guidance to folks has always been: if there's any question in your mind or my mind after you've asked what constitutes a legitimate campaign expense, don't list it as a legitimate campaign expense. Pay for it. You know, it's personal. It's personal. You're going to go out and you're going to buy a wardrobe. It's personal. Things of that nature. And don't do it. And don't start saying that, hey, I used three tanks of gas this month, but I was really going from this function to the other function. So really two of them ought to be related and one of them not. Well, it's true. You can do that. But I always tell them, you got to be very, very careful about it, because there is no just standard definition of what constitutes a campaign expense versus a personal expense. You just have to use your common sense.
Well, Jim, we have, I hope, an opportunity again here before the campaign wraps up. It's right in the midst of the campaign. We hope you have a chance to have you back on and answer any more questions if we have them. And we appreciate you spending time answering questions today.
Thanks, Chris. As you know, I love doing it, and I'll do it whenever you need me.
Well, thank you very much. That's Lake County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Weiser.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.